Good evening and welcome to tonight's episode of Editing Aloud, where we'll be talking about the day's dramatic events which started last night in Zimbabwe. With me tonight are Tim Cohen, editor of Business Day, Ray Hartley, our digital editor, as well as the FM deputy editor, Sukonathi Manjanja. We'll just get into it, gentlemen. Last night, dramatic events in Zimbabwe, military takes over. What does it mean for Zimbabwe and what does it mean for SA, its neighbor? Tim?
You know, I mean, it's very interesting, this coup, because first of all, you know, when somebody on a military uniform came onto the TV to say there's definitely not a coup taking place, you know that you're talking about a very odd coup, you know, but it is a coup.
Yes.
So, but it's interesting because obviously what, you know, the preceding events mm-hmm. were that Robert Mugabe nominated his wife mm-hmm. as the new leader of ZANU-PF.
Yes.
Ousting the
deputy president,
and that has sparked a whole kind of turmoil within the party, and now essentially what's happening is that the existing powers within ZANU-PF, they're not trying to change power. They're not, mm-hmm. this is the oddity of it. Mm-hmm. What they're trying to do is solidify their own power within mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. within the party. That's and it seems like they've done it mm-hmm. As we sit here, you know. So it's not completely clear, but I would bet they've got it under control. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of constitutional problems because you know Robert Mugabe's is elected directly, right? Mm-hmm. So he can't really be, you know, it's not like in South Africa, he can't be ousted by parliament
or his
own party, you know. So how they get around that problem
will be very interesting for them. Ray, your take on it, what are the implications and what does this mean essentially?
Well, I think it's a very clever coup because it's not a coup, because what they're doing is protecting the president mm-hmm. and his wife at their residence. And they haven't removed him from power. Because as soon as they do that, remove him from power, it's a coup mm-hmm. in the dictionary definition. Mm-hmm. And then SADC and the world will have to make a decision about what to do and to condemn it and mm-hmm. With the implications and sanctions and all that. And whoever takes over will then be an illegitimate mm-hmm. Leader. But what I think they're trying to do is force Mugabe to step down voluntarily and to install this guy, Mnangagwa, who was chucked out by Mugabe mm-hmm. as a sort of acting president until they can have an election.
Sukonathi, I mean, why has it taken so long for this moment to come in Zimbabwe? And is it a moment to behold for Zimbabweans?
Oh, Lisa, there's something first. I learned everything in the English language. Ray says they will force him to step down voluntarily.
Yeah. Well, they'll ask him to step down.
They'll politely pour him a cup of tea. And
so obviously the story changes by the hour. As we sit here this evening, Jacob Zuma has already confirmed that the man indeed has been kept very safely in power at his own residence together with his wife. So by the end of the show, a lot will have changed. Why has it taken this long? Mm-hmm. It's exactly what we're going through here.
Yeah.
That one little step, one incident, you mm-hmm. remove one vice president, you remove one president there. Everyone keeps thinking, it's not me, it's just Joyce Mujuru, it's just Canon Banana, it's just...
Yeah.
Until if you remove Mnangagwa, you've removed them all. The great crocodile is out and all the minnows definitely know they have no place, regardless of their role, which they believe they're entitled to. Mm-hmm. As you did hear General Chiwenga saying, we who played a role in bringing this revolution about. So they feel entitled, and now we remove the biggest crocodile in the room, and they think, okay, now we've got a... And you're putting, as they say, the criminals like Joyce Mujuru, Grace Mugabe, who's
yes.
trying to steal the president's via a marriage certificate, someone said last week.
Mm-hmm.
They feel all vulnerable because they should. If Robert Mugabe has got no respect for Mnangagwa, mm-hmm. has got no respect for Joyce Mujuru, and these are the people that not only fought colonialism and won, but they also massacred their own people. They were together in the trenches.
Yeah.
If you can get rid of those, it just means I, as General Chiwenga, am nothing. Tomorrow you'll get rid of me, as he did try yesterday to get rid of Muka, of Chiwenga.
So there's also an element of self-preservation as well
it
in
is.
The main
actors. No, more than that. It's a total. It's all about self-preservation.
Yes.
I mean the backdrop to it is that the economy stabilized for a while. There was a period of but recently the inflation has come back, not in the form of money inflation, but product inflation, which is something that you can't stop.
Yeah.
So the economy is in a very bad way, worse than it's ever been. It was clear that something had to go.
Yeah. All right, moving on to the next topic. Now we're going to talk about yesterday's bond sale. It was a record bond sale for SA. However, investors were asking for a premium in terms of the interest that they're charging. What does that mean?
Well, it just means that we pay more for our debt. The estimates that Treasury were putting out really not 6 months ago, that South Africa's debt level, debt to GDP ratio, would stabilize at around about, somewhere between 50% and 53%, are gone. It also suggests that by the time that the rating agencies sort of finally come out with their decision, the market would have already sort of moved and would have priced it in. I mean, I had a look yesterday. It was quite interesting. So Brazil's 10-year bonds are trading around about 10%. Ours are trading around about 9.5%. And yet, Brazil is theoretically
junkier than junk.
And we're not even junk. So it's clear that the markets are expecting the at least one of the two rating agencies, most probably both of them, to put South Africa fully in junk status.
How did we arrive at this point, Ray?
Well, I mean, it's the fact that we have this massive shortfall and that we have to borrow. And I mean, this was the biggest bond sale ever. And it's going to become a regular sale of this size from now on, and the price is much higher.
Yeah.
So it's the indebtedness which follows from a failure to control spending and a failure to gather sufficient revenue. Simple as that.
So, Cole, in terms of your ordinary South African, why should you be concerned about what's happening?
That's exactly the biggest problem. For the first time in this medium-term budget statement, for the first time, the finance minister did not increase the social grants payment in October, did not increase the old age pensions. Now, not many people noticed that except those that do receive them.
Yes.
That is the key. It starts there, stabilize it, and then it goes down.
Yeah.
What it basically means is that more and more money, Malusi Gigaba said 15% of the budget now gets spent on service and interest. That has just gone up.
Yes.
More and more money will be taken away from the social grant recipients to service debt, which means in real terms the social grant payments and old age pensions will not grow. And when we adjunct, and when we are now begging for our sovereignty at the IMF, they will say, reduce those payments too high. That is what it means. It's one step at a time, and that's how we got here. We've been junked for the past 10 years. Our credit ratings have been dropping, and we have not noticed until at the very bottom. That's where we are.
Okay. Briefly, before we go to our ad break, nuclear, the controversial nuclear program, is it back on the table? Because there's been a lot of ratcheted up talk about the fact that, the recent reshuffle was a signal that it was game on again.
Yes. I mean, we don't know. I mean, every time someone says it's off the table, someone else says it's on the table. It's on the table. Every time everyone says, well, it's definitely not going to happen. No lesser person than the finance minister said that just immediately after his appointment that it was, fiscally impossible.
Yes.
But then the Minister of Energy said that it was possible, and they were going ahead with, the opening up the bid process.
And the president himself said the nuclear is going to happen.
Yes.
Now, he, of course, we all know that Jacob Zuma has got no concept of money, but if he ever needed any indication that there is no money for the nuclear, he only needs to look as far as Eskom.
Yeah.
There's absolutely nothing to pay salaries after December. Yet he goes on about nuclear. He wants another 40 billion rand for the university fees, things that are...
He wants to go on a massive shopping spree, basically.
He goes, exactly, when the wallet is completely empty, he goes on a massive shopping spree. And he knows absolutely nothing about money. If you needed any confirmation, this is it. Of course, only if the money does go into his pocket does he recognize it.
Okay. I mean, Ray, is it realistic for us to want nuclear in the current economic environment?
Well, no. I mean, it's completely unrealistic. I mean, there's no way that we could afford to finance a capex of that size and impose the debt on future generations, the most expensive way. Mm. And there's a very big global report being released about how nuclear is now the least chosen option by any country that's developing energy infrastructure.
Okay. And then, I mean, lastly on this point, would they be able to do anything at all before the conference in terms of pushing through some sort of anything on nuclear?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the conference is so divided over leadership issues. You know, theoretically the conference is going to address some policy issues too, but realistically, with such a contested conference, just seems unrealistic.
Does this lend credence, Sukonati, to talk that there are other forces that are behind this program, and then we've made commitments that we have to honor?
There's no other way of explaining it. There's absolutely no other way of explaining it. Jacob Zuma is desperate for this thing to happen because promises have been made to other people that we will give them a nuclear deal. And we have seen no less than 4 statements coming out of Russia that we have the nuclear deal in South Africa. That is why. And he knows, just like Robert Mugabe, he's on his last legs now. Once you go to the conference, anything can happen there. So he at least needs to be showing his friends that, hey, we've started the nuclear process, we've delivered, comrades.
And then lastly, I mean, does this undermine, like you've mentioned earlier, Eskom is battling on its feet. Does this undermine our power producer programs, our renewable energy program?
The fact that we cannot produce nuclear and we should not be producing nuclear is great for the economy. It actually is good for Eskom because, as we have said, it does not have a cent to its name. There's absolutely nothing there. It's great that we can't do it. But the fact that Jacob Zuma is pushing ahead against all evidence that we can't afford it is really bad for South Africa. It's showing why the rating agencies have been so wrong for so long in not junking us as early as March.
Yes,
it just shows
it was too optimistic.
Exactly.
Okay.
They were too optimistic, and we have taken every opportunity to show them how wrong they were.
All right. Then we have to take a short break. There afterwards, we'll be discussing more of these hot topics. Welcome back to tonight's edition of Editing Aloud. Back to more pressing matters with regards to South Africa. We've had the dramatic resignation of Michael Sachs, the head of budgeting at the Treasury, this week. In terms of our budgeting process, what does it mean and what does it say, and what message is that sending out?
Well, this is very extraordinary. You know, it's amazing that a Treasury official, that the RAND can drop a percentage point on the resignation of a Treasury official, not the Finance Minister, not even the second, it's very symbolic what's happened here because Michael Sachs was in charge of the Budget Office. So this is basically the organization that coordinates and filters the different needs from all of the different departments and really makes the difficult choices about who should get what. And it was always done, with impeccable professionalism and
sound.
Yeah. And the idea was always to try and keep South Africa's fiscal integrity intact, right?
Yes.
So now it appears that there is that the whole process has been subverted in a sense. There's a cabinet committee which will issue a mandate. to the so they've so you know really this is a kind of a very important internal struggle within government. Mm-hmm. You know the which is very worrying because as Sika was saying the you know we are sitting with a government that doesn't sort of seem to recognise you know expenditure limits. You know they don't seem to respect them or they've given up on the idea of them or they're so desperate to try and win support through you know
whatever means necessary
that they that you know the borrowing requirement can you know is to be the last requirement.
Ray, does this tie in at all with you know the rumours that are swirling about this announcement that President Jacob Zuma is going to make about free fee education?
Yeah, I think that's a definitely. I mean, it's this tussle who runs the country's finances.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you know Pravin Gordhan was removed, and we can now clearly see he was removed so that the presidency could move in and actually determine how the budget is done.
Mm.
And you know, no less a person than the president's future son-in-law is the person who's proposed this 40 billion rand expenditure on free education at the expense of a bunch of social programs.
Mm.
And now, you know, the next thing is the whole nuclear question. So there's a standoff. Lucy Gigaba thinks that he can say that this is not making fiscal sense, but President Zuma doesn't care. You know, his closest people are his security aides, and he's made one of them energy minister, and he has said we're doing it. So there's going to be a standoff, and if Gigaba doesn't come on side, Gigaba will be gone. There are already rumours that he's on
his
the outside. And might be out.
Okay. Sukunati, in terms of this no-fee higher education proposal that supposedly this Masuta character proposed to Jacob Zuma, the Sunday Times was reporting at the weekend that it was stopped by the Treasury before Jacob Zuma made his State of the Nation address earlier this year. What conditions gave rise to this new emboldened attitude that they can suddenly go to the Treasury and dictate to the Treasury?
If you remember, early this year, there was something called Budget Office that was created in the presidency. And it was made at that point to sound like the president would have the final say on the budget.
Yes.
That was shortly after removing Pravin Gordhan. And now this is their first major decision. And of course, he wants to leave a legacy of the president who made education free. Never mind whether that is possible or not and the quality thereof. But that's where it is. And Malusi Gigaba cannot stand up to Jacob Zuma and say no. So the president goes right ahead and does it and appoints Mpumi Mbofu and others in the president's in Jeff Kantebe's office to specifically look at the budget at the school at the no fee universities. And that's because the minister now he has will not say no. And he knows that. And the minister, of course, knows that for the next few months, he still owes his existence in that cabinet to the president.
President Jacob Zuma. But then do the politics surrounding the no-fee debate now defile a legitimate discussion about the structure and the efficacy of higher education? Because the fees that they're charged at universities, are quite exorbitant, especially for students who come from severely poor families. And some of that is being lost because of what's happening in terms of the political maneuvering.
That is a discussion we should always have had as a nation, and there was a time of plenty, that time of harvesting that Malusi Gigaba mistakenly put now. That time is now gone. We were talking about just now about a huge deficit in the government. We cannot at this point, as the economy stands, and it's certainly not in the manner that Jacob Zuma wants to introduce that, you cannot afford it at this point. Definitely we should be able to put free university education for the poorest people in this country, but that is not how government policies are done, government processes are done. You do a cost-benefit analysis and see what you can do. You can cut, for example, 50 of those ministers and deputy ministers there and start funding maybe the first 1,000 students per year.
Yes.
That's how it starts. You don't just go big as if you're going to go home afterwards. No, you have to keep going and you start small.
Okay.
But Jacob Zuma just thinks he can do it.
But I mean, this is, you know, the interesting thing about this is that it's in contradiction to the Hare report, which was proposing a subsidized fees for both poor and middle class kids.
Yes.
But you know, the kind of irony is that, you know, university students, you know, at the time that they're at university, they're very poor, right?
Yes. But
they are, in the longer term, over their kind of lifespan, they are, you know, some of the most
upwardly mobile,
and there's no reason why they should benefit necessarily more than in a situation of constrained resources than somebody who is, you know, looking for a job, you know, who would never be able to get one.
Yes. The
vast majority of university students would be able to pay back their fees, mm-hmm. You know, over the duration of their careers. So the question is really, do you really want to specialize that group? You know, you want to lift them out and say they are the ones that should benefit from the system the most.
They can organize themselves and march to your offices in Pretoria. You definitely want to.
You want to make a plan for that.
You know, the commission had a very wise thing, which is that, you know, you would repay these loans contingent on having
the money to do so.
Yeah. So if you graduate and you get a job, and you have, and that job is pays you sufficiently, you then start paying back. But if not, then you don't pay back, so you don't have that obligation.
And it should be said that, though, you know, worldwide the trend is towards university students paying something
towards their education,
which is precisely because they end up, you know, in the best paid jobs eventually, you know, so
yes, yeah.
It's only fair.
Okay, something also that's related to the fiscus. Dan McKeeler, the PIC CEO, was in Parliament yesterday, and he told parliamentarians that the PIC is not averse to investing in SAA. Your thoughts, Sukhanati?
He's said that before, but there are conditions. SAA has to be managed like a proper corporate company, and at this point it is not. And SAA has to be rated at investment grade. At this point it is not. SAA has to guarantee a return on investment of inflation plus 200 basis point. At this point it is not. SAA has no governance. He has said that before, and he repeated it yesterday because he was being pressurized. When are you guys investing in SAA? Why are they interested in the PIC investing in SAA? Because all the money has been stolen everywhere else but the PIC.
Yeah.
So they are desperate for anyone who can sign a check. And Daniel Machila at this point is the person that can.
Sign off on a big check. Ray, will the union federations allow that? I mean, they've made a lot of noise about saying, you know, their pensions mustn't be touched and they will kick up a firestorm if Dan McKeeler or anybody else invest their money into SAA?
Well, you see, I know the set of conditions outlined there, I think that, you know, no, because the, you know, if SAA achieves all of those things and including a return above inflation guaranteed, then there wouldn't be any reason to complain. But under the current circumstances, it would essentially be just pouring the money down the drain. And that I think they would definitely not accept.
What I would love to see in that conundrum is when the workers themselves, let's say a formal decision and a request to amend the processes that govern the investment of the PIC, if it is put, I'd love to see whether the workers will say, okay, the 11,500 workers that work for SAA can go to hell. We're not putting our money there. Love to see them make that decision to save the pensions or save those 11,500 jobs. It would be best if they were on that board of the PIC, formally represented and voting on 25% of the vote and say, let's make a decision. We shove our money there and it sinks as the rest of the money has, or we let those guys go.
Okay. Yes. And then finally, yesterday as well, on Tuesday, Eskom board spokesman Kulani Khoma made testimony to the ongoing inquiry into governance issues at Eskom. And he made dramatic testimony about Public Enterprises Minister Lynn Brown. Yeah. What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think that Sikos knows much more about this than me, but I think, you know, all of the... the chickens are coming home to roost. You know what I mean? Mm. You know, so this is what happens if the organization starts, you know, going bad, is that, you know, you get, it just increases infighting. There's more and more people who sort of like make a grab. You know, they say, my chances now of getting money out are sort of less. So the level of malfeasance escalates. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, it's everybody's involved. You know what I mean? I mean, it's, and the revelation is just
extraordinary.
Extraordinary, shocking. And they're blaming each other, they're telling each other they're lying, you know.
Sikho, your thoughts on this, briefly?
It's great that people are standing up to Lynn Brown and calling her a liar, because I personally have for quite a long time believed that there's something wrong about Lynn Brown. Mm-hmm. The truth about her may be very, like, maybe the worst thing to come out. And what better place to come out than Parliament, where there's parliamentary privilege.
Okay, and then finally tonight, we end off on a light note. So we found out the bad news. Unfortunately, South Africa is not going to be hosting the 2023 Rugby World Cup. I see that you're quite sad. You're looking very despondent.
I think it's terrible. I wanted to see, you know, the Jacob Zuma put on the number 6 jersey and walk around the stadium, and everyone says, Jacob, well, I know.
That's a very pessimistic outcome in December that you're looking at.
Is this good news for us? I mean, many people said we couldn't afford to host it in the first place.
You know, at the rate where the way that we're playing at the moment, you know, we might not qualify. At least as host, you automatically qualify. So it's bad. It's terrible news.
Look, it's the best news ever. It's really the best news ever that we will not be hosting another party for the world at our own expense. 2010 left us with a huge bill. Mm-hmm. We've done the Cricket World Cup before, we've done the Rugby World Cup before, we've done the Soccer World Cup before. We have proven we can host these things. We have arrived. We did not need to do it again at the expense of South Africa. Look at Brazil. What did the World Cup do for them?
Absolutely nothing.
Exactly. We've saved a lot of money, and we've just come out of that Olympic fiasco that that Figile Mbalula had organized. Yes, the Commonwealth. So it's really great news that we are not able to host this World Cup. And of course, I wouldn't want to see Nkosazana Dlamini sonking around with a big T-shirt, like extra large.
In any case, we lost to France, where we won in 2007. Maybe that might be a good omen for us. Thank you for joining us for tonight's edition of Editing Aloud, and good evening.